broadcasting worldwide from a studio inside global headquarters of RP Enterprises in Kansas City.
Hey, gang!
Ladies and gentlemen,
Papa's home!
This is the Papa Ron Podcast.
File transfer in progress.
With Ronnie Phillips and Jillian Gregg.
Showtime.
And we're back, 46. Now episode 46 of the Papa Ron Podcast. And excited about this virtual podcast. You can see this on Spotify or YouTube. And before we start with today's guest, I just got to remind you about this great tasting coffee that you can get over at our partners at DirtyDuckCoffee.com. You know, we came out with this brand new blend of coffee to kind of help support the Papa Ron Podcast because although we're not trying to make millions, we wouldn't be mad if we did.
Yeah, I'd be okay with that.
But it is more about the mission and about the entertainment than it is about the money. And so this particular blend of coffee is called Gratitude and Empathy. It's just as much about the mission of starting your day with gratitude and empathy than it is about the actual great tasting coffee that is a smooth Brazilian medium roast, as I like to say. Kind of brings you the taste of nostalgia. So check that out. Use promo code PAPA, that's P-A-P-A, on Gratitude and Empathy, or any of their coffee blends or any of their merch that they have over at DirtyDuckCoffee.com. Super excited to have this guy on the Papa Ron Podcast. Gosh, this friendship has gone back probably 20 years, roughly 20 years when I made the venture from Eau Claire, Wisconsin to Tucson, Arizona to work for Clear Channel Communications to launch the all new Coyote Country, which was in the same building as 93.7 KRQ, which hosted the night show with R-Dub and Sunday Night Slow Jams. I present to you from San Diego, California.
Nice.
He's got a few different names, Randy Williams, Ramblin' Randy, but I know him and many others on Sunday nights know him as R-Dub. Welcome to the show.
Welcome.
What's the name of the coffee that you were promoting just now?
Gratitude and Empathy. It's a smooth Brazilian medium roast.
I'm going to order it. I am drinking frustration and back pain, and it's not as good as what yours sounds like. So yeah. put me down for a bag.
Yeah, no doubt. Definitely go over to use promo code PAPA so that way you can save when you go to DirtyDuckCoffee.com. And we're going to follow up Gratitude and Empathy with a nice, strong bag of piss and vinegar. That's probably the next blend that we're going to come out with. Anyway, I digress. R-Dub. We go back 20 years, man, and I, one of the things that I remember about coming to Tucson and meeting you was that you were just over. I mean, you got to understand, Jillian, R-Dub was a fixture, much like, say, Johnny Dare is in Kansas City,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
One of the biggest personalities.
Yeah.
That was kind of like R-Dub, and then they had the John Jay and Rich Morning Show on KRQ, was a household name in Tucson. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be possible that when people reach a certain status of clout or celebrity, that they could have an ego. Mm. Not this guy. This guy was lots of humility, very gracious, was very kind to me. R-Dub, I remember doing the clubs with a place called the New West, and right next to it was the was a hip hop club or a top 40 club. What was the name of that place?
So it was a giant like complex of two different clubs. It was the New West, which was, by the way, the original club was called the Wild Wild West. So they reinvented it and called the New West. And then the club next to it was called Gotham.
Gotham, that's it. So anyway, when he was doing his radio appearance for Gotham, I was doing my appearance for Coyote Country at the New West.
Yeah.
And so we got to hang out and have some drinks. And I was telling Jillian, R-Dub, off the air, I guess, that you invited me to a New Year's Eve party at your house that I showed up, and you had just finished your home studio. And I remember walking in there, or maybe you hadn't just finished it, but it was looked relatively new. And I remember walking in thinking, the dude's got a radio station in his house.
Yeah.
It was incredible.
You know, that was an amazing time. I mean, that was going back to probably 2001, 2002.
Yep.
And that was, not to get technical, but for folks who are listening to the podcast that may have their own podcast or their own setup at the house, that was at a time before there was such thing as home, really common, inexpensive, or even affordable home studio. So right. Back in the day, if you wanted to have a radio station in your house, now like most of the personalities on radio have setups and they're good to go, a few $100. Yeah, back then, man, that was tough. And I remember the only way I was able to afford it is I would go on eBay and I would buy you know, commercial grade equipment one piece at a time. And I stored it in my bedroom until I finally had everything. And then I hired an engineer and we put it together. And yeah, we literally had a radio station out of my house. And, you know, again, today it's kind of common. A lot of people have home setups. Back then it wasn't. So it was an interesting, fun thing. And I know we're going all over the place very quickly, but let me just touch on that. The coolest thing ever was the very first time that I'm doing my show from my house in Tucson, and the phone rings and I pick up my request line, and it's a lady listening from Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I remember it just blew my mind. Yeah. Like, wow. I was doing this without satellite dishes and without a big, you know, ABC radio. This is just myself, just R-Dub.
Yeah.
And an ISDN line. And anyway, you give me a great flashback of that house and that studio and some very, very good memories.
You know, I'm going to go back to something you said earlier, because when I was putting together my home studio in my apartment, and after seeing what you did, you brought up eBay. And I remember you coming into the Coyote Country studio saying, I've got eBay figured out. Because back then it wasn't just like go to eBay and buy. You had to put a bid on it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there was a time on it. And so R-Dub would say, okay, so you open up this browser and you start here, and then you open up a browser here. Mm-hmm. And when you get right to the like last few seconds, then on this browser, you can go ahead and hit your price. So you can put in your price. You remember this? Do you remember doing
that? I remember figuring the system out 100%.
Yeah.
It's the technical term, if anyone is a pro at eBay, is called sniping. And it's basically you go in at the very, very last minute. Otherwise, if you bid on something that the auction ends in 5 days, you're just driving up the price.
No doubt.
You set an alarm, you wait for the very end, you put your max bid in one time.
Yeah.
And then you usually get it.
And so I learned that from R-Dub and was able to buy some equipment for my home studio. All right. So this is my fault for taking this thing in so many different directions, but I've been following you for years, obviously, since we become friends, and just seeing the height of your success. And there's so many things that we could start with and talking about. And, you know, I'll just kind of put a teaser out there. R-Dub is a person who has traveled the world. I remember R-Dub telling me when I was living in Tucson in the early 2000s that it was his goal to visit every single country. Kind of laughed at it like, yeah, but good luck with that, pal. And then recently has achieved that. So we're going to get into that. Now has a syndicated radio show with Sunday Night Slow Jams. I know Jillian's got some questions about that, but you're on like 200 radio stations across the world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. And that's not just in the US. Like they're doing slow jams in many other countries.
Yeah, I think we're at about 230 stations. It's tough to keep track. You know, stations leave and come back in, but yeah, 17 countries, 225 stations. You know, some big ones: New York, you know, LA, Chicago, Phoenix, and San Francisco. But just to touch on that, I honestly, and I truly mean this, I am just as passionate about playing slow jams for, you know, McAllen, Brownsville, Texas, I am for New York. In fact, you guys are in radio. You know, a lot of times smaller market radio, the people are even more invested and more passionate, and even, you know, give you a little bit more attention or even, you know, a closer ear in Yakima, Washington than they might in Los Angeles or San Francisco. So I'm addicted to that. I told myself I'd like to be in every single market in the country. So we'll continue to do kind of like the countries. I mean, you know, with so many things in life, it's about building brick by brick by brick. And you never, you know, rarely can you get from A all the way to Z in one shot, but you get there by going to B and then to C and then to D. And, you know, with anything, you keep at it and consistency and hard work. And all of a sudden you're at, you know, W, X, Y. Oh, my God, I'm finally at Z. Mm. That's you know, that was the story with visiting all the countries and also with the slow jam show.
Wow. So this feels like a dumb question. Did the traveling help your show getting into some of these other countries? Like, did you go to, I don't even know, fill in the blank with a country that you're on the radio in? Did you go there and meet with radio people and go, hey, here's my show? Or is that even like, is that not how that happens?
No, you nailed it. 100%. That's happened. Yeah. And I wish I did that more. When I go on vacation, I really try to go on vacation and not do a lot of business. But yeah, no, absolutely. I've went into radio stations and met with the program director, and then it's cool because it's a very organic way to introduce your product. You know, you're just a silly radio guy from America visiting, and then you get along with these people and you have a rapport, and they say, what do you do? And you're like, well, I do a show that's on a bunch of stations. And then half the time they'll say, well, I'd love to, can we run the show? And then you're leaving with a contract. So yeah, that happens. Oh. It's been cool.
So you're telling me the mindset then was to just go to the country to go on vacation. And then while you were there, it was like, yeah, I got a little bit of free time. Maybe I'll go visit radio station XYZ and introduce myself. Because I would think as the savvy entrepreneur you are, you would be premeditating this so that you can write this off.
That's it. Bingo. You're absolutely right. And if I ever end up in jail, it will be because of... crazy tax write-offs, because I do write my trips off.
Let's start back to the beginning. You got into radio or had a passion for radio at the young teenage age of 14. Is that correct?
About 12 or 13 years old. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. And so it was just basically because of a passion for music and staying up and listening to the personality on the air that it kind of inspired you to want to pursue this as a career.
I'll try to be as brief as possible, but it's a very special story to me because it was the point that changed my life. I moved to a new city and state across the country, and I didn't know about slow jams or urban radio. I turned on my radio simply to find the pop radio station, and I could have I moved from LA, so I'd listen to 102.7 Kiss FM in LA. Oh, yeah. Boy. Rick Dees. 1989, Rick Dees, right? And so I turned on my radio in this new city, which happened to be in Orlando, Florida. And of course, there's no 102.7 out there. So I could move the dial to the people who grew up in the 90s. Remember the radio dial? It was literally a dial. I could go to the left or to the right. And I went to the left, and I stumbled upon a show called The Quiet Storm, which was on the black urban radio station out there. And I didn't know what urban music was. And they were playing slow jams. And the very first song they were playing spoke to me so much, specifically about a girl that I was crushing on in seventh grade. And I remember hearing the song, and I'd never heard this genre of music before as a 12-year-old white kid, and hearing the song and thinking, man, how do they know that's exactly how I feel about this girl? And like, how do they know? Like, that's the perfect song. And then the next song, and then the next song, and then something really interesting happened. The song ended, and you heard this rain effect for like 30 seconds. And this DJ come on with a super deep voice, and his presentation was like no other presentation I'm used to hearing. I'm used to listening to Rick Dees on Kiss FM. Mm-hmm. Now I hear this radio DJ who's supposed to be hype, but he's mellow and he's chill, and he's reading a list of dedications of people calling in. So he's basically cultivating this special late night relationship with his listener. So that was the moment that I became hooked on slow jams, or AKA The Quiet Storm. But I bring up the specifics of turning on my radio and moving the dial to the left, because had I moved the dial to the right, I would have landed on Orlando's pop music station and probably would have stayed there and would have never learned about slow jams or The Quiet Storm. But it was that moment that changed my life. And I said, I want to do this. So.
Wow. That reminds me of the whole left and right thing. Now reminds me of like, now when you hear people, it's like swipe left, swipe right, right? Like for like dating apps or whatever. So like, I mean, but similar thing, like, well, if I'd swiped right or if I'd swiped left.
Yeah.
I don't know.
We were swiping. That's funny. Yeah.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah, kind of.
So that's where it all started, and really it changed your life, because now you have a nationally syndicated show. And I guess this is a very presumptuous thought, or maybe even question, but like, you could probably live on just doing a syndicated radio show, right? Like, I mean, that has been a huge opportunity for you.
I'm 47. So I left local radio when I was 30 just to do slow jams. And what was amazing is I remember, you know, I started this show called Sunday Night Slow Jams. Every Sunday night I did it at the radio station almost as a volunteer, because I was full time. I didn't have to work on Sundays, but I would come and I would literally bring a crate of CDs in every Sunday night to the radio station since I was 15 years old. And years later, it got syndicated. I got a, you know, on a bunch of different radio stations, and I started making money from a show that I had done for free my whole life. And I remember, you know, the first check was like $300, and I was elated. I'm like, $300 for a show that I do anyway. Now I could, yeah, you know, go out and have a fancy dinner. And years later, the checks slowly crept up and then surpassed the salary I was making as a program director and afternoon host at the radio station in Tucson. And so at 30 years old, guys, that's when Tim Richards, you remember, was our boss. That's when I walked into Tim's office and I resigned and I moved to Brazil to do slow jams, literally on the beach. I rented an apartment out there, top floor, right on the water. And I did my syndicated show. So the answer is yes. I work in radio today just because I love it. I'm at a couple of amazing local radio stations here in San Diego, California. It's a nice, you know, kind of second salary, but no, the answer is, yeah, that happened 17 years ago. And I don't say that to brag. I say that because I feel very fortunate, and it's a testament to everyone else out there who, you know, want to start their own business and want to be entrepreneurial and don't want to just, I do use the word slave, but just be indebted to their full-time employer. And I'll say one last thing. I remember at the time, specifically in my 20s at the radio station, I remember there was, I don't know if gossip's the right word, haters maybe. There were haters in the building saying, you know, R-Dub's doing slow jams and that's not, you know, that's outside of the scope of his work here. And that was before, the word side hustle was even a word. I was doing that. And I remember I was getting hated on. And fast forward 10 years later, you know, the radio industry is just, you know, chewed up and spit out so many amazing people because they've done all these cutbacks. Your employer and these companies aren't loyal to anybody. So I've been doing the side hustle for 30 years now. And, you know, even when that was taboo, and now it's like, man, if you're not doing a side hustle, people think you're strange. Everyone's going to have to. So anyway.
Right. Jill had some questions about what actually defines a slow jam.
Yeah. So if you aren't catching on, I kind of am the one that asks the dumb questions. What is a slow jam? Like, I know, like I said that to Ronnie, he's like, well, you know, like R. Kelly. And I'm like, no, I know what some of them are, but like what all encompasses and like what's the timeline of a slow jam? So how far back do we go? Are we talking like Otis Redding? Are we, I don't know.
So, I mean, it's very subjective, and honestly, who am I to tell you or anyone what a slow jam is? I used to be a little bit more of a purist. And you know, for example, one of the biggest debates was, specifically, I remember, is Pony from Genuine a slow jam? And I used to say, no, it's not. It's too up-tempo. It's got the burping sound effect. As my show has had to become more mainstream to reach different markets, I've had to create different formats. So, you know, for example, I have a different version of slow jams that I run on, you know, hot AC stations in New York City. And we play, I mean, we even play Ed Sheeran and Taylor Swift and I'm trying to think of some of the other ones, Adele. So the word slow jam is subjective. You know, if you want, on the broad sense, it's really any jam, any song that's slower, you know, that's obviously not super, super duper fast. You know, my favorite slow jams, you know, are from the 70s to the 90s. I think that's when the music was the best. So anywhere from Marvin Gaye and Teddy Pendergrass, sure, Otis Redding, you could say Smokey Robinson. For me, I think the 90s were the best slow jams ever. You had a million different, you know, even on top 40 stations, every other song was a ballad, from Boys to Men, Casey and JoJo. You mentioned R. Kelly. I hate not being able to play his music anymore because his music was so good. Keith Sweat, Aaliyah. The 90s gave birth to so many amazing slow jams, and there are hundreds more I could talk about. If you want to get more niche, Tony, H-Town, Troop, all these, Jodeci, all these boy bands, all these R&B boy bands, and the girl groups too. You had SWV and you had 702, you had Total, you had Jade. So you had all these, the 90s were amazing. And you didn't ask, me this question, but I'll tell you, if I can tell you my personal favorite genre of music would be, not genre, but year. It's very specific for me, 1987 to about 1991 or 92. Those, for me, was the masterpieces.
Wow. And so then how does that translate? You said you have different, you play like a different compilation in New York City than you do somewhere else. So how does that translate then to other countries? So you mentioned like Brazil. Are you on in Brazil?
So I would love to be on in Brazil. I'm not on in Brazil. Okay. But let's see, you know, South America, a lot of the Caribbean, Lagos, Nigeria, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. And I was not signed up by a Nigerian prince. This is actually a real radio station. That signed me up. They didn't have to send them any money. Mm-hmm. But no, they picked the format. So we have a format where it's just the classics, just the 90s that I mentioned, just Boyz II Men and you know, the classics. I have a format for hip hop stations where it's a lot more Usher, and you may hear you know, some of the other R&B stuff like SZA and artists like that. I have a pop version I mentioned with a lot of Taylor Swift and Justin Bieber. So yeah, different versions, and radio stations can pick their own version depending on their format. Hmm.
Man, well, I'm just so proud of you and what you've been able to do, and not letting any of that hate or negativity stop you from chasing a dream. And I think we would both say that neither one of us, when you started doing this, did you have the vision that it would grow to the level of what it did, or were you just having so much fun in the moment?
You know, I never, ever, ever thought that my show could be syndicated for the mere reason that, you know, the masters of slow jams and the Quiet Storm, you know, growing up as a kid, and even now, the best ones, man, they have this voice of God. They have these Barry White sounding voices. Mm-hmm. I do not have that. I don't pretend to have that. I talk a little softer when I'm doing slow jams, but I don't have the resonance, you know, like our friend Rick Hunter and folks like that. So, you know, when friends of mine in Tucson, when I was doing it locally, and they would approach me saying, hey, you know, you should syndicate the show, I honestly said, I don't have the tools. I don't have the God-given booming thunderous voice to do it. But you know, just by chance, two radio stations at the very same time contacted me, and they said, hey, can you send us a version of the show we can run? And so I'm like, yeah, I'm building a studio in my house. This is perfect timing. I just sent them the show and it worked. And again, the short story is, the condensed version is, I started sending my show to these stations, and the numbers, the ratings took off. And I think it was my sixth radio station was Anchorage, Alaska. Wow. I remember telling myself, man, if this works in Alaska, if this Tucson, Arizona show works in Alaska, I think it can work anywhere. And Alaska was one of our biggest success stories. And so again, I just applied the method of just building it brick by brick by brick, you know, and here's the deal with really anything in life, especially sales or affiliates, you know, if your goal is to get 100. For example, my goal was, hey, let's get on 100 stations. Well, if I can be successful in 5 or 7 or 10 stations, that's not a fluke. You just then apply that to the next 10 and the next 10 and the next 10. And that's with everything in life. I wrote a book on syndication. If anyone listening is in radio, you can go to my website and get the book. But that's really what it's about. Had it not worked on those first couple of stations, it would not have worked on 100 stations. But, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I guess a restaurant, right? If you invent McDonald's and it works in 20 cities, chances are it will work in 40 and then 80, et cetera. So, but to answer your question, never in my wildest dreams.
Yeah. What's the book called?
Book is called Go Syndicate Yourself.
Okay. And you can only get that through, say, your website, or is it on Amazon? Where can people find it?
Which is a play on words, like go yourself, but go syndicate yourself. Yeah. It's on Amazon. Yeah.
Awesome. So this is probably in the book, but I'm curious because, I know you're probably not real familiar with the Papa Ron podcast, but we talk to all different walks of life. There's a strong focus on mental health and bringing people in who kind of play in that space. But there's also the personal development side and the entrepreneurial side, because those are all things that are fascinating to me. So I'm curious as to how you turn, and you can give me the 30,000 foot view of this, but how you turn a syndicated show to profit. Are you selling the show to the radio stations, or are they, are you making the money on the advertising that you have on inside the show, or is it both? Give us a vision of what that looks like?
Yeah, there are different models. And as a radio station program director, I also carry syndicated shows. So I'm on both sides of the spectrum. The biggest, the most common model, the model I'm at is, I give the radio stations the show for free, and then they run the advertisement the ads that I place inside the show. And the more radio stations we have, the more audience we have, the more money we can charge. So we can go to Geico or Coca-Cola and say, hey, we can get you on. We can, you know, give you 4 million listeners. You need to pay us this much for a commercial.
So, gotcha. And so with the direction that linear broadcast is going, be it TV or radio, and you said it yourself, it's kind of getting chewed up and spit out. And so how is Slow Jams in this project that you have? How are you combating the linear versus the digital, or how are you playing into the digital space? Because what I've learned in with my TV show, being in the linear space, that you got to be good at the linear, but you can't disregard the digital. You got to play good. You got to be good at both. You got to be good at all of it.
The great news for me is it doesn't require me to do much work at all, because, you know, and I hear from listeners who call in, you know, if they're in their house, they are listening on the radio station's app. So, you know, I'm on 230 radio stations. Probably 99% of them stream online or stream the app. So listeners find the show. And it's also, you know, it's with my show and with other successful shows, it's an appointment. There's a reason to listen. It's a destination. It's a specific niche show that serves certain music for a certain kind of people and does a certain service. And so the good news is, a lot of that work is done for me, and all these radio stations stream. So it's not hard to find the show on the new mediums.
We talked a lot about Slow Jams. I could keep going and on because we're radio junkies and I find it fascinating, but let's move into the next thing. Then this mission that you had at a very young age to travel to every single country in the world. Here we go. And now the set is being moved.
Magic.
I love it. That is incredible. If you're not watching on Spotify or YouTube, you have no idea what we're talking about, but the backdrop to our dub has changed to the worldwide map. Where did this start? Where did this passion to want to visit every country?
I traveled to Brazil when I was 26 solo by myself, because my best friend kept canceling. And I finally said, I'm not getting any older. Let me go by myself. I was scared to death. I said, man, is going to Brazil by yourself, which was really the first country I ever visited outside of Mexico. Is this going to be like going to Disneyland by yourself? Am I going to hate this? What happened was I experienced the 10 best days of my entire life at 26 years old. And I wish I had done it even earlier. And so it started there, and I realized how amazing it is to be so far away from everything, you know, and traveling to a new country, especially if you're away from tourists. I'm not talking about going necessarily to Rome or to Paris, but really traveling off the beaten path, especially solo. I'm a big proponent of solo travel. It feels like you're starring in a movie. It feels like you have a separate life. And as I get older, and as we all get older and we see our parents pass, our friends pass, you know, it becomes apparent that we only have one life, and it starts to become real. Traveling for me is the closest thing to having literally multiple lives. When I travel to some of these weird countries, you know, I detach myself from work, and no one knows I'm R-Dub, and it's like I'm a new character in a new movie. Brazil was when I was 26. I started visiting South America, and as I racked up the countries, I said, you know what? I have a challenge. I want to challenge myself to finish all of. I feel like the weatherman. I'm pointing at the map. I want to challenge myself to finish every country in Central and South America by the time I turned 40. I was able to do that right before the buzzer. And in doing that, I found some very bizarre countries in South America, specifically including a country in South America whose official language is Dutch, and they don't speak Spanish at all. And so the bizarre really intrigued me. And then from there, I'm like, I'm going to go see the whole world. 10 years ago, I went to Europe and saw 7 countries in 10 days. And I just did the math. I broke out the calculator and I said, if 7 countries, 10 days, what if I just kept repeating this pattern? I could probably see the whole country or the whole world in a decade. And that's what happened.
That leads me to my next question. Crazy. Like, how much money are you saving now that you don't have to travel to this country or that country to get another notch in the.
So I'm still traveling just as much. I've negotiated a ton of vacation time from work, but what I'm not doing is I'm not having to do. I think there was one trip where I counted 19 flights in a 3-week period because I was going. Now what's nice is I can go to a country and stay. And so I'm saving a lot of money. I still have the same amount of hotel rooms and meals, but the airline travel is not as crazy as it was before. So yeah, good question.
Have you done a tab or a tally on what you actually paid to take on this venture? What the actual, I mean, I know it's kind of skewed because you talk about drinks and food and all that stuff, but just for the core basics, the travel, the lodging, what is it that you paid in the grand scheme of things to go to 193 countries?
I cannot tell you because I honestly don't remember. I'd have to look at tax records. What I can tell you is that I fly the most expensive tickets are the overseas tickets, right? From here to here. Mm-hmm. Here we go. And I use those using credit card points. So I every stick of gum that I've bought, every sandwich since I was in my early 20s, I use on a credit card that gives you miles. Mm-hmm. I also sign up for the credit cards that give you these enormous bonuses.
Sure.
And so the most expensive flights, the international ones, I almost always get for free. So that's a huge benefit there. You know, and you know, to folks out there that, you know, may want to try this, or, you know, maybe they don't even travel at all because they think it's too expensive. It's never been less expensive in the history of travel than traveling now. It's never been easier with the internet. I mean, how could I have ever done this without the internet? I don't know. Mm-hmm. But there's budget airlines. There are hostels. There's even something called couch surfing, which I'm not brave enough to do. But have you heard of couch surfing? Do you know what that is?
No, but the hostel, I just found out about that like a year ago. And I was looking for a place to stay out in California. And it wasn't just me, but I was like, wait, 3 of 8 beds. What is this? What is this? And is that a misspelling? It's a hotel? No, it's hostel. What is this? And then I'm like, oh yeah, no, I don't want to do that.
Yeah. Not for me, but I have friends that do that. And like, wow, that's again, though, these folks are on a budget. Couch surfing is an app. I guess you could compare it to Airbnb, but you don't pay anything. You show up and you sleep on someone's couch.
Oh, stop.
You're part of a community. And in return, I think you're supposed to maybe give up your couch as well. And maybe you bring them a bottle of wine. I'm not sure because I've never done this. Couch surfing is a thing. It's a very hippie thing, but it's a thing. But my point is, though, if you want to see the whole world, you like anything, if you want it bad enough, it's absolutely attainable.
How did COVID affect that trajectory of you getting to accomplish your goal?
That's an amazing question. And, you know, I must preface it by saying, you know, having a little self-awareness of, you know, so many people died and lost their jobs during the pandemic. Who am I to cry boo-hoo because I couldn't travel? But that being said, it broke my heart. I'm on this trajectory to finish every country in the world. And then this crazy disease and pandemic absolutely shuts travel down. That being said, I do have a little bit of a flex here, a little humble brag. Of course, I had to cancel, like I had 4 or 5 trips in the hopper that I had to cancel, and it was and a million flights. And so that was a big pain in the butt. But I was glued to the news and I was waiting. You know, think about it. This is my biggest passion in life. Probably even more than radio at this time. And, you know, I'm at, I think 110 countries, maybe 120, and then everything grinds to a halt. So I'm glued to the news on, you know, okay, what country is going to open? Because if you remember, it wasn't all countries at once. It was one at a time a country would open. And then you'd hear about it. All of a sudden is, you know, Guatemala is open for tourism. So I saw in the news that Hungary or the EU was going to be open for tourism in July. So I jump online and I buy a ticket and I'm so excited. This is 2020, by the way.
Yeah, July 2020. Yeah.
After I buy the ticket, a friend of mine who was in Europe, I tell him, hey, I'm coming over. And he basically writes back and sternly corrects me. And he's like, no, dude. These countries are opening for each other in the EU, meaning, you know, if you're in the EU, you can, you know, go to, they're not opening, they will not let Americans in. So I had this ticket. I went online. I found out there was a loophole and I applied with the Hungarian police for a special exemption. I had to hire a Hungarian translator online to help me with the application because it was all in Hungary. And I basically had to book a business meeting in Budapest and apply to the Hungarian police and say, hey, I'm a businessman and I'm coming in and I have a meeting. Please give me permission. And holy crap, they did. So July of 2020, I show up to LAX, which is absolutely barren.
Yeah.
And I get on a plane and I'm like the only American to fly into the EU and I get into Hungary and I'm in, you know, all these main squares where you know, Hungary is probably Budapest is one of the most visited countries in Eastern Europe. And usually you're elbow to elbow with tourists everywhere. I'm now at the main square and I'm like the only one there. It was phenomenal. And then once you're in the EU, this is very illegal, but I rented a car and I drove all around and I went to Austria and I went to Germany and Amsterdam and Slovenia. And I felt like the luckiest man in the world. And I couldn't tell my work either because they had a travel ban as well. So I was posting photos on Facebook of R-Dub's Great American Road Trip. And it was pictures of me in Texas. I'm like, look at me, I'm in Texas.
Oh my goodness.
I was really like in Slovenia. So right. Anyway, it was amazing. But to answer your question with a short version, I didn't let it stop me. I traveled the crap out of the world during the pandemic.
What was your business meeting?
So I actually did do a business meeting.
Yeah.
It was a radio meeting with like a friend of a friend. Mm-hmm. And it was to discuss slow jams. And I may have missed the meeting once I landed in Budapest.
Right.
I booked the meeting. I had it booked.
Right. So that was legit. So then you said, you know, I did something very illegal and drove from here to here and here in Austria and all these places. Were you nervous at all? Like every time you would cross a border. I don't know if like our borders there, especially at that time, is it like driving state to state where you don't know, or is it like going to another country here where there's like a checkpoint and you go through and there's a, you know, process.
So on normal times, the EU is like the United States where, you drive through and, you know, no one cares. No one's looking at passports.
Yeah.
During the pandemic, before I got there, apparently there was not even kind of inter-EU travel allowed. When I got there, that was done. But I mean, just like by the nick of time. And as I was bouncing around to these countries, like you got to remember July, 2020, there was no vaccine.
Right.
And so even during that time, for example, I went to Belarus, I left Belarus. And like the day after I left Belarus, they installed like a crazy lockdown. So I was actually dodging lockdowns. And to answer your question, there's also, and this is like really in the weeds for travelers, but inside the EU, there's some countries do check passports. The ones who don't are inside something called the Schengen zone. I didn't even know this. And so I remember flying from, was I flying from Amsterdam to Bulgaria? And apparently I left the Schengen zone because I'm walking to my gate and they stamped me out and I'm like, oh crap. And I arrived in Bulgaria and they did not let me in. They sent me right back.
Oh no.
And I couldn't go back to where I came from, Amsterdam, because that was the EU. So I had to go somewhere completely different. So that's a great question. And it's really weird how all those rules are made up. And it was such an uncertain time, but I was so lucky to be able to check off all of those countries and I had to be very quiet about it.
What is your favorite country? Well, Brazil, I think I could probably guess that, right? I mean, going to Brazil is maybe one of your top three countries.
Brazil has to be number one because it's the only place I moved to and I quit my job and I actually lived. But my top three are Brazil, Philippines, and Turkmenistan.
And why is that?
Philippines for me has the friendliest people. They have a love for Americans. And you feel like, sure, this plays into ego, but you feel like a celebrity. You feel like they love Americans so much in the Philippines and they're just so friendly and so, and it's genuine and the smiles and the warmth of the Philippines. So Philippines for the people. And then number three, Turkmenistan is a country that reminds me of North Korea. It's very controlled. It's very locked down. There's a dictator. it's very weird. It's very bizarre. And it's bizarre because, for example, the Capitol, which is very big, right? The Capitol, you can only drive a car if it's white, silver, or gold. That's just one of the many weird things about Turkmenistan. All the buildings are white marble buildings. There's a lot of interesting idiosyncrasies about Turkmenistan. So it's a very mysterious country. It's hard to get into. They don't approve a lot of visas. And it's very under the radar as far as the press goes. There's been a lot of documentaries on North Korea, for example, not a lot on Turkmenistan. So I found Turkmenistan fascinating for so many reasons. They have some of the most beautiful people there and the culture there. And finally, I'll tell you about Turkmenistan. My one takeaway is Turkmenistan is very, it's modern in some ways as far as technology and infrastructure, but the values, it feels like you're in the 1920s where, you know, the ladies still all wear dresses and the fellas all dress up and wear nice button-up shirts. And you don't see a lot of tattoos. You don't see any beards or purple hair there. Not making fun of anyone here in America, but my point is it's a throwback. It feels like you're somewhere in your grandparents' times. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I love it. Yeah. Turkmenistan's, I'm booked to go back in September if they grant my visa. So,
dumb question time. Where is that?
Turkmenistan is in Central Asia. So it's surrounded by Iran, I believe Afghanistan, Uzbekistan. Yeah, it was correct. Kazakhstan. Yeah. So it's right in the middle there.
All the stands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'd naturally then have to go the other direction. And what were some of your not so favorite? And did you have any hairy, scary situations being in, say, any communist countries?
So I'll give you my least favorite first. By the way, Italy is not a least favorite of mine, but I was having a conversation last night with a friend who texted me and says, "Hey, I'm going to Italy. Do you have tips?" And I'm going to get a lot of hate for this. But I told him, I go, "Man, I don't really love Italy. And I can't even tell you why. I don't dislike it. I think it was built up so much for me by people, including my mother, who, oh, I love Italy." And I went and I didn't get the vibe. When this sounds very pretentious, but I think everyone feels this way, whatever they do in life. When I land in a country and I just start walking around the capital just to get lost, I get a vibe, and I either get a great vibe, a bad vibe, or kind of in the middle vibe. I just never got a great vibe from Italy. I just never, like, I love this place. Okay. I don't know why. I like it, and I would certainly return, but I don't love Italy. But my least, I like Italy. I really do, but I don't love it. My least favorite country is this one right here, Cameroon. It's in Western Africa. I just got a really horrible vibe there. People were in a bad mood. They weren't smiling. This guy yelled at me for taking a picture in the street. And in fact, I blogged about Cameroon. And then one of the local digital newspapers in Cameroon, I guess, didn't like me because I blogged that I didn't like Cameroon. They wrote a fictitious article about me and that wrote some story that I had slept with some girl who drugged me and stole my wallet. And I'm like, I mean, totally made up, by the way, completely made up.
Wow.
And I'm reading this, and I'm like, where do you get that from? Cameroon is bad vibes. But who knows? Maybe I'll give it another chance. You cannot judge a country on your one day. Also, believe it or not, as amazingly sexy as Nepal sounds, Nepal was one of the countries that I left early. There's been only two or three countries that I've actually left early and said, get me out of here. Nepal was one of those countries. I landed in Kathmandu, which is the capital of Nepal. And after literally one walk around the block, I'm like, I don't like it here. And not only did I leave Kathmandu the next morning, I had like 3 or 4 days there. I went to Yemen instead, which wasn't on my itinerary. So if that tells you a lot about Kathmandu, get me out of here. Get me to Yemen. and I actually loved Yemen. A scary time in my life was crossing the border between Rwanda and Burundi. And for the sake of time, the short story is the border crossing wasn't one that was used much. And apparently I didn't study. And those two countries have a history of they're very volatile against each other, very volatile relationship. So all of a sudden I'm at a border crossing and like I'm like the only one there. And if you've ever crossed the border, you realize that's where all the commerce is and the music and the people and the vendors and families, like, you know, borders are usually really busy. So I got to this border. I'm like, nah, no one's here. That's because no one crosses the border here, dummy. And as soon as I crossed, I was surrounded by the police and soldiers, and they basically stuck to me like glue the entire time. The second deputy in charge decided to get in the car with me and drive to the village and accompany me the whole way and charge me a fee every time I stopped to look at something. It was really weird. And that night I ended up buying him and all his comrades beers at the bar. And I didn't even mind all that. I just the unsettling vibes. I was afraid that they were going to bust down my door at 2 a.m. and take me to jail, put some false charge on me and try to, you know, extort, I don't know, $30,000 from my family to release me, you know, from jail, et cetera. So that's a whole other podcast there, but it was very unsettling and there were a lot of unsettling moments. And I was basically many times looked at as a spy, like CIA, especially because of the haircut. They're like, you work for the police, you work for the CIA. I'm like, no, I'm just a tourist. And Burundi was, yeah, it was very scary. And then other time, I don't know if it was scary, but I was detained trying to leave a country. So if you've ever watched Locked Up Abroad, if you guys ever watched that show?
No.
You need to watch it.
Okay.
It's like 40-minute stories. It's called Locked Up Abroad. It's 40-minute, very well-done stories of why people get locked up abroad. Most of the time it's because they're doing stupid stuff and they've got drugs shoved up their keister. In my case, they thought I was a journalist and journalists weren't allowed in the country. Okay. And I was in a Pacific Island nation. So I was in the Pacific, which is, I mean, that's like flip-flops and chickens. So I wasn't worried. There's a lot of places you don't want to get locked up in, like, you know, Russia or Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. This is an island country. So whatever. But anyway, I was detained. And they took me downstairs, little chair, little dark room, went through my phone, asked what I was doing. So it was like a textbook detainment right out of the movies. And so there was that.
I'm thinking about you going to these countries and you are adamant about doing it alone. I'm trying to think about having the mental fortitude to know that I'm going into a particular country where I could be subjecting myself to this kind of turmoil. You had to have spend some time educating yourself on these different places that you were going. How much time did it take to actually do that, to know what you're potentially getting yourself into, and then how to respond if these certain particular detained situations presented themselves?
So the craziest places, especially in the very beginning, I always made sure I had a guide. So I would love to sound like some heroic, you know, adventurer, but you know, I think Haiti may have been the first place I went to that I was a little scared because I just heard things about it. So I got a guide. I got a guide in Haiti. Libya was probably the first holy crap, what are you doing country that my family was like, what are you going to Libya for? In Libya, you know, I had a guide. In North Korea, I had a guide. In fact, in North Korea, you have to have a guide. Yeah. And also in Syria and Iraq, I had a guide. And finally in Somalia and Venezuela, I had a guide. So I think that's about 8 or 9 countries. And half of those countries or a quarter of them, I would probably return without a guide. But the rest, I'd still have a guide. So the answer to your question is, you know, in the crazier countries where there's more turmoil or there's, for example, there's civil wars happening, I had a guide. You know, gosh.
How do you find a guide and what does a guide run?
So it varies. It varies so much. Some of the more dangerous countries, the guides are expensive because they realize the only people that are doing these are these eccentric Americans. And well, you must have money if you want to visit Somalia for tourism. Yeah. So for example, I think the package was like $2,500. It included hotels, but it also included an armored car and a truck in front of you with three or four guys with Kalashnikovs. And that was wild because, yeah, you actually feel like you're like a president or something because you'll go to the main square. And I actually felt bad because I'm like, dude, I don't want to interrupt people's day at the park. And the guards will come and make all the locals scatter so you can have a selfie in front of the monument. Oh, I actually felt a little crappy doing that because I'm like, who am I? Like, who am I to interrupt your day at the park? But that's just the way that was safety precautions, you know?
Sure.
So anyway, guides vary. Afghanistan was another place I had a guide. But man, there are so many travelers out there that they'll do couch surfing in Afghanistan. They won't even have a guide in Afghanistan. There are people that are so much more braver than myself. But yeah, in some of those super, super sketchy countries, I'll have a guide.
Did you?
I'm just like, I can't even imagine. I know,
right? It's hard to fathom.
I really can't.
My question was going to be, was North Korea as bad as it seems with the way the news portrays it to us here in the States? Which leads me to actually a bigger overview of the question is, was there any country, say, like North Korea, where maybe it wasn't as bad or it exceeded your expectations in a good way?
Absolutely. And that's a great question. You know, if we only had 30 seconds to go on this podcast, if it was the quickest podcast ever, 30 seconds with R-Dub, and you would say, hey, what did you learn? I would say that the world is not as dangerous as the media makes you believe, with the exception exception of Somalia. Somalia is a failed state, and it's just, it's the wild, wild west over there. Unfortunately, Somalia, if you don't look like a local, if you are my skin color, or anyway, if you don't look like you're from Somalia, you are a absolute target. And there are even children on the ground in Somalia that if they see someone that look like you or me, they will text their boss saying, "All right, we've got it. We've got an American in the market," and try to blow you up. So,
with the
exception of Somalia, what I've learned is that the world is a much safer place as the media would want you to believe. And I learned that going to Haiti the first time, where I walked around and people were nice to me. I also learned that in Libya. You know, I was in Libya and I was literally, I lost sleep. I was scared to death. But my first day in Libya, I'm in the main square and there are couples holding hands and children riding tricycles and a man selling balloons and popcorn. And this is a country that's in a so-called civil war. I have friends that have visited Ukraine over the past couple of years. You know, one of the things you should know that even in places where war is breaking out, it's usually not the whole country. So I'm not telling you you should go to countries that are, you know, in having war. But the fact is that I could probably go to Kiev today and have a great time. And you know, again, not for the average traveler. But yeah, places are safe. And even, for example, Baghdad now, you can go to Baghdad, Iraq without a guide by yourself and be fine. And I will touch on North Korea. North Korea is this sounds crazy. North Korea is the safest place for a tourist in the world. And you say, well, how can that be? Well, North Korea is one of the only countries where you are looked after 24 hours a day. You are not you are not left out of sight by your tourism guide, which is also a government worker. So no one will mug you, will pickpocket you, will scam you, will stab you or rape you when you're in North Korea. It just won't happen. Now, you got to follow the rules. Don't do dumb things.
Right.
You know, act like you're in church or act like you're a visitor in someone's house. But North Korea, you are so protected and so sheltered versus going to Paris where, you know, there's muggings and stabbings all the time. It happens here in the U.S.
Yeah.
So some of the most dangerous places are some of the most places with the most freedom, like the U.S., like Paris or London. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. So when you were in North Korea, did you feel like that you were treated as, say, a celebrity or even got better privilege as opposed to the people who were locals there? You talked about in, I can't remember which country, you've touched on a lot of different countries here, but which one that you were in, that you were in an armored car and, you know, if you went to a park or something, then the guides would have those people be removed.
Yeah.
So did you get preferential treatment then in places like North Korea where you were getting better food, better, you know, get clean water, things like that?
Yeah, unfortunately, North Korea, and I obviously won't comment a lot of on the politics and standards of countries because I want to return. And when you apply for visas, they go social media and they search and they want to know what you've said about the country. So, you know, you can do your own research on North Korea. But I do know kind of the same thing as Cuba. We'll say that because Cuba's a little more liberal about letting you in. I'll compare North Korea to Cuba. When I went to Cuba, unless you're not self-aware at all, you realize that, you know, tourists are living the good life. Yeah, we stay in the good hotels. We get the good food. If you're living in Cuba, you know, you're probably living in poverty or living in really dire straits. So I think you should definitely be aware when you go to some of these countries that, you know, the life you live as a tourist is not necessarily what the people are living. North Korea, I was scared leading up to it. I booked the trip 8 months out and I knew no one who had ever went to North Korea. And and all my friends were begging me not to go. And, you know, 4 months before I left, an American got held and detained in North Korea and sentenced to like 10 years hard labor. I had found out that he was actually part of the tour company that I was going with. So there were all these signs like, dude, don't go. But I went and I loved it. And I really, really want to go back.
Okay. So if I were going to, let's just hypothetical situation. You said you loved the Philippines, right? That was one of your top three. Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So if I'm going to book a trip to the Philippines, okay. Do you recommend like going directly through an airline or using one of the sites? Like, I don't even know. I haven't looked up things in a long time, like Kayak or Hopper or one of those, like, cause you talked about using miles, like credit card points and miles and things like that. But what would you recommend on that?
I have some very, very, look, I'm pretty open-minded about a lot of things, but I do have black and white rules. Always, that's a great tip, right? We could do a separate podcast just on all the travel tips.
I'm sure, yeah.
I'm going to give you that idea. We should do that where it's just people
want to do it.
Just give them tips on the whole thing. Well,
for real.
Part two with R Dub.
But the answer there is to never, ever, ever book flights on a third party website.
And the reason
is this: you may save some money. You may save $20, $100, whatever. If you ever have any problems, you're virtually helpless. They will not help. You're up the creek without a paddle. So it's fine until there's a problem. And
right. It's not.
It only takes one time. And so I've resigned myself to never, ever, ever, never book on Travelocity or Kayak for flights. Always go direct with the airline.
Yeah. And best airline for international travel.
Wow. Qatar Airways is nice. They have something called the Q Suite, which is wonderful. I've never flown international on Emirates, which I'd like to, but Asiana is also very, very luxurious. The American Airlines international are like my least favorite. Yeah. Some of those Asian carriers like Asiana, Qatar Airways, very, very, very nice.
All right. So in closing, there's a few things that I wanted to touch on. Jillian might have a quick question or two.
Hold on. Are we recording? I thought this was just the pre before we start the podcast. This is the actual the podcast.
Yeah, this is the pre before part two when you give us all these great travel tips. All right. So I want to talk about Slow Jamistan. I want to talk about Kelly Clarkson and I want to talk about Shark Tank. So okay. Which of those three, you obviously you've been on Kelly Clarkson's show. You've been on Shark Tank. I absolutely, as an aspiring entrepreneur, love that show. I could just watch it for hours and hours and hours. Yeah. I was so proud of you when I saw you on there. And then just give us the whole story about what the hell is Slow Jamistan?
So Shark Tank was one of the best days of my life. I mean, I have in my head, I have like three or four days that will go down forever in history as like the best days of my life. And I didn't go on Shark Tank to get a deal. I went on Shark Tank to get on the show. I just wanted to get on the show. Mm-hmm. And my one goal to be on Shark Tank, you could find it on YouTube, I think. Mm-hmm. Search Brian McKnight, the singer. I brought Brian McKnight on with me. But my only goal was to get on Shark Tank and then not be made a fool of. I just wanted to not be made fun of.
Yeah.
Because then none of my friends would let me would ever forget that. They would never let me forget that. They were nice to me on Shark Tank, and I didn't get a deal, but I had the time of my life. And you know, imagine being a guest star on your favorite show of all time, Shark Tank.
Yeah,
one of my favorite shows. Just being there was like, it was so cool.
Yeah. Did you spend time with any of the sharks outside of just that time you're in front of them?
No, and I wish I did. And I wish I would have. My one regret is I wish I would have asked for a selfie with them. I just didn't. I didn't want to be that guy. Yeah. I did see Damon. Was Damon John? Is that his name? I did see Damon years later at a club and talk to him and stuff. So
that's cool.
I love those guys, and I thank them for not making a fool of me. Mm-hmm. because they'll do that to people, as you know. Kelly Clarkson was fun, and I was on Judge Mathis like 30 years, 25 oh, years right. ago.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
Suing someone, and I won. and then, yeah, we'll close with Slow Jamistan, and I will tell you that the Sultan and R-Dub are never in the same room together, but, you know, without talking You're, about...
Bring your microphone back to you closer if you can. There you go.
Without talking about Slow Jamistan, this is the world's newest country, and all of your listeners should Google Slow Jamistan, and they will go down the rabbit hole. We have our own currency. We have our own passports.
Wow.
We have our own laws. Crocs are strictly forbidden in Slow Jamistan. what else?
So when I just type it in, just in the Google search bar, and I think I spelled it right. Let me see. Yep, spelled it right. Republic of Slow Jamistan, Salton City, California.
So you can read all about it. We've been on CNN. We've been on some fun TV shows. But yeah, Slow Jamistan is the world's newest country, 11 acres. It's surrounded by America. It's in the California desert. And it is my country. We have 17,000 citizens. We have a great national anthem. We have some fun laws. The Sultan is a very strict but loving dictator. And it's a great place to be in. And you can apply for citizenship. It's absolutely free.
Wait, what is the – I do have to know what the national anthem of Slow Jamistan is.
Yeah, can you listen for us?
I will not sing it for you.
come on.
Republic.
I'll tell you, a lot of people think it sounds like some guy named Elton John, which I don't know who this up-and-comer named Elton John is, but a lot of people say it sounds like Rocket Man from Elton John. So if you know that that cadence and that melody, it's called Slow Jamistan, and it's a great song.
Okay. So Slow Jamistan is inside the borders of the United States, but is not a part of the United States.
We are not. Nope. Completely separate. We declared independence December 1st, 2021 and notified the White House and the UN. And we have, like I said, we have our borders. We have a border patrol and a checkpoint. And
do they work for free, or are they paid to government employees?
Oh, they're paid. They are paid in doubles, which is my money that I just showed you.
That's incredible. And so how, I've just got to ask, because I know we're closing and maybe hopefully it's not too long of an answer, but where did that vision come from to do this? Like this, that's really kind of way out there, dude.
So believe it or not, there's like 200 of these things all around the country.
They're really?
Called, yeah. They're called micro nations, and they're a real thing. And one of the most famous ones is in outside of Reno, Nevada, and it's called Molossia. And it is probably one of the most well-known in the world. And I visited Molossia a few years ago in between my international trips. I was getting antsy. I didn't have a trip planned for a few months. So I booked a ticket on Southwest Airlines to Reno and rented a car and went to Molossia. And I met the dictator and the president. And I said, man, this is cool. I want to do my own country. And I didn't honestly even think of doing it at the time, but I did joke. And I said, we'll call it Slow Jamistan. And then, unfortunately, it's a double-edged sword, man. Once I get an idea in my head, it's like a runaway train, man. Good or bad, it's going to happen. And so far, this has been the worst financial decision of my life. But
I was going to ask you, like, if you do that, because like we have a few acres, and like if we just declare ourselves an independent country, like then are you like tax exempt and all that?
I mean, I wish, obviously, let me tell you this. I sent the county my tax check. But on the memo line, I wrote, this is not for taxes. This is foreign aid. You know, don't spend it all in one place. And they wrote me back. They're like, we can't accept gifts. It's definitely taxes. And I wrote back, nope, it's a gift.
Oh, my goodness.
So it's a lot of fun. But no, man, Slow Jamistan is in reality, it's been the most fun creative outlet I've probably ever done.
That's so cool.
And actually matches my passion for radio. It's super fun because you can do whatever you want. Yeah. And as I mentioned, 17,000 citizens, a national anthem, passports, money. We go to conventions. We do appearances on television shows. It's been a lot of fun.
So you guys, Slow Jamistan has its own Twitter handle. You can follow R-Dub at R-Dub. And then Slow Jams is at Slow Jams. Is that right?
That's right.
Fantastic. Before we let you go, anything new in the hopper, as you like to say, for the future with R-Dub?
You know, gosh, what else? I'm I'm becoming, this is a weird, but I'm becoming I've always wanted a second passport. So I'm becoming a naturalized Mexican citizen. I took the test. I took the exam. I passed 100% and I'm waiting for the paperwork to finish. So I will literally be a Mexican, which is interesting, which is cool. When you live on the border of San Diego and Mexico, it's cool because you can, you know, cross as often as you want. I bought a place out there. My brother lives right across the border as well. I am just having fun. I'd love to be on the podcast. It's phenomenal to meet you, to talk to you both. Ronnie, of course, we've been friends for decades.
Yeah.
But I appreciate the podcast. Appreciate you guys having me on. I hope anyone listens to this, you know, doesn't think I'm a complete crackpot. I'm just a guy having fun. And I'd love for you to follow along on the social medias and be a part of Slow Jamistan. And Jillian and Ronnie, I do expect you to apply for citizenship today. You'll be approved. I'll green light you. I promise.
We'll do that. I will say this in closing, and I told Jill this off the air. You know, Rick Hunter, you referenced him earlier as a friend of ours, mutual friend. He is the imaging voice of the Papa Ron podcast, and all of the imaging production was done by our late friend who recently passed, Rich Donovan. And so I can't do a podcast with R-Dub and give some sort of shout out or tribute to Rick Hunter and our late friend Rich Donovan. May he rest in peace. So R-Dub, I love you, dude. Thank you for taking some time out of your day there at the radio station to visit with us. And man, look at all those patches.
I wore it for you today. So.
I appreciate that, dude. We're going to do this a part two, and we're going to do some travel tips somewhere down the road. I love you, man. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Have a great week. Thanks for listening. All right.
Thank you, buddy. That's R-Dub, Randy Williams, Ramblin' Randy, in episode 46 of the Papa Ron Podcast. And don't forget, check out this great blend of coffee, Gratitude and Empathy. It supports what we're trying to do here with the Papa Ron Podcast. It's a smooth Brazilian medium roast. Use promo code PAPA to buy this or any of the coffee blends or the merchandise over at dirtyduckcoffee.com. For R-Dub, for Jillian Gregg, I'm Ronnie Phillips. That's episode 46 of the Papa Ron Podcast.
You've been listening to the Papa Ron Podcast. If you enjoy this podcast, hit subscribe now on the podcast platform. Follow the Papa Ron Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok.
And while you're there, like, comment, and share.
Until next time, thanks for listening to the Papa Ron Podcast.
Papa Ron Podcast.
Papa Ron Podcast.